Good evening, everybody. My name is Candace Huddleston. I'm an alcoholic. Judging by the numbers, we're still drinking more, or they're still making more booze than we're able to drink out there. There's a bunch of you folks. I'm one of those real corny people about Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah, I just love it here. And I get a little Pollyannish about it, and so I'll try to not to do that. This is not a natural place for me to be. It's natural for me to be in Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's not natural for me to be standing up here. I just hate it. Let me get that over with. But when your fiendish secretary called me and asked me to talk, it was a little intimidating. He said, "How would you like to talk at the largest AA meeting in the world?" And I said, "I would not like to do that." But, you know, I grew up in this sort of Gestapo school of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the way I grew up in the program is that they told me that you never refuse an AA request. And so that stuff that I learned early on in the program has stayed with me. And so I just never refuse an AA request. I'm grateful that this was not Bakersfield or, you know, someplace. But it hurts more for me to, you know, I feel more guilty to refuse a request than I do feel bad about doing it. You know, it's the lesser of two evils. People who know me don't believe this, but I'm really basically very shy, and I like to be sort of in the half measures group back there in the back someplace, usually sitting with my arms folded, not talking to anybody unless you speak to me first. God knows I wouldn't stick my hand out. And sitting there being judgmental, that's kind of, you know, I spent a lot of hours in Alcoholics Anonymous doing that. That's not the way to do it, in case you're new. I'll get to the way you're supposed to do it in a minute. But that's not the way you're supposed to do it, but I've done it that way. And you know, I didn't have a lot of serenity or a lot of peaceful, happy sobriety when I'm doing that. And so what I have learned is that, you know, it just, those folks that told me all that Nazi kind of stuff in the early days were exactly right. You know, you just don't refuse an AA request, and you do all this dumb stuff they tell you to do, and then you begin to feel a little better. And so that's why I'm here, and I'm really glad to be here. The program has been wonderful to me. I'm just, you know, as I say, a real corny kind of Pollyanna person about Alcoholics Anonymous. I have never known a group anywhere that treats one another with the kind of dignity and love and caring that we do here in these rooms. And everything, the product that you see standing here tonight, is what I've learned from you. I mean, you have helped me put my life back together, and you've taught me everything that I know. So, you know, this stuff that I'm going to regurgitate out to you is a product that I've learned here. And I'm real grateful to be here, and thanks for having me. I have some friends in this group. It was really nice to come here and see some old friends that I have not seen in a long time. It's interesting, though, the only one of you that wanted his name mentioned was Vince. And I really wasn't going to mention it, but I saw him at dinner up the road a piece, kind of pontificating over each table as he went around. And I thought, you know, I got to say something about Vince. Even if it's not good, you know, I got to say something about Vince. Vince and I first met years ago. I'm not sure exactly when, but we got to know one another through, you know, life is strange here. If you haven't been around long enough, stick around. It gets real weird sometimes. But Vince and I got to know one another through a good friend of ours, a mutual friend who was dying, and who was my very closest friend. And out of her death and her loss came a real friendship, and it's a real treasure to me, and I'm glad to see you, and your friendship means a lot to me, Vince, and I thank you for all the help you've given me through the years, especially through that loss. It was real important to me. I grew up in I should tell you that I always have a lot of trouble following rules, and, you know, our big book gives us an outline of how we're supposed to talk. We're supposed to say what happened and what we were like and what happened and what we're like now. And I like to talk about sobriety. I don't like to talk about all that other stuff, but I need to do that to qualify so that you'll know I fit here, and so that I remember and, you know, why I'm here. But I sort of bounce around a lot, so if you're having trouble following, it's I'm having trouble with it too. So I bounce around between sobriety and, you know, drinking and sobriety. I will get drunk in a minute. But I guess I better get born first. You know, I was not born drunk. I grew up in this southern, thank you. I grew up in this southern Texas family with real nice people. It was just kind of your ordinary alcoholic family. And there wasn't any abuse or anything, but it was just unpredictable. I mean, I just never knew what was going to happen. And both my parents were alcoholic. And my mother's alcoholism progressed later than my father's did. And so there was somebody, you know, there was one stability force in the family. But as I grew up, I began to think that the stability force was really me. I just never fit. I mean, I didn't fit in this family. I didn't fit in this little one-horse town with 2,500 people in it. I didn't fit in the Baptist church. And no offense if you happen to be Southern Baptist, but I grew up in a kind of atmosphere where everything is a sin. You know, I mean, whatever it is, whether you've thought it or done it, it's wrong. No dancing, no wearing, ladies couldn't wear pants, you know, that kind of stuff. No makeup. I mean, real strict stuff. And my family was not like that, but my grandparents were, and they were a big influence in my early life. And from the get-go, I was a people pleaser. I wanted to make everybody happy. I mean, and you can't do that, you know. And I always compared myself to other people. I mean, I was always comparing, and I always came out on the short end of that stick. I never measured up. And I can remember, you know, the other thing is that I remember. I remember being obsessed with drinking. I wanted to drink before I ever wanted. I mean, I can't remember ever wanting to do anything else. I did not want to grow up and get married. I did not want to grow up and have children. I didn't want to grow up and have a business. I just wanted to grow up and drink. And I didn't have many goals beyond that. I just thought, you know, I'll be glad to be a big girl so I can drink. And the other thing that I wanted to do is I wanted to go off to someplace glamorous like New York. And be a jet setter and be exciting and romantic. And I had a lot of illusions about that, but it was all around booze. It was all around booze. That's what it was all about. It was centered on booze. And so when I was 16, I had my first drink, and it was champagne. And one of the 10-minute speakers said he didn't remember his first drink. I'm thinking, geez, I mean, you know, I thought we all remembered our first drink. I mean, I remember mine. It was the answer. It was it. It was champagne, and I was 16 years old, and it fizzed and hit bottom, and it was instant for me. It was instant. I looked better. I was attractive. The boys liked me. I liked them. I could talk to them. I remember this little voice in the back of my head said, "Aha, this is better than you thought it was going to be." I mean, I just loved it from the outset. And I didn't get drunk, but within a year, I was blackout drinking. Every time I drank, I blacked out. I don't know what social drinking is. I don't know what a line is that we cross. I mean, I was there from the very beginning. I was there. And it was wonderful. I mean, I liked it. I didn't understand getting sick, but I thought, well, you know, everybody I was hanging around with got sick too, so it was not too much of a big deal. The other thing that was always bothered me growing up is that I never quite knew where I fit. There were rules, and I'm a big one for rules. And I grew up in a kind of a traditional town. We lived in this little town, and then we moved to Austin, Texas. And all my friends, it was like the rules about what you do. And I never knew. I always walked close to the edge. I always played it close to the edge. I liked the rules and I thought they were wonderful, but they didn't apply to me. But I wanted to fit in. You know, the rules were for everybody else, but I expected somehow that I could disobey the rules and get by with it. You know, my case was different. And so the rules that applied to everybody else didn't apply to me. But what I had was a lot of conflict because I liked all the wild kids. You know, I mean, they drank. And I got in trouble. I mean, I'm dating myself a little bit, but the guys I ran around with stole hubcaps. I guess they steal cars today or something. I don't know. But I mean, that was the big deal. You know, they'd steal hubcaps. And I liked that crowd. But I also liked the kids that made good grades and that the teachers liked them and they didn't get in trouble with their parents. You know, so I had one foot in each camp. And so when I started drinking, I mean, booze just made all that easy for me. It made it just, it was the magic answer. And I loved it. You know, I thought this is even better than I thought it was going to be. The rules in my town and with my friends were that you went to high school and you graduated, and then you went to college, and then you graduated. And then in June, the year you graduated, you married him. And him was from a good family, whatever that meant, you know, and he had a good future in a profession, and he had drove a nice car, you know, real important stuff, external stuff, you know, looks and money and all that stuff, and that's what you tried to get. And the thing that was hard for me, though, is that I never liked women much. Early on, I didn't like. It took me a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous to learn to like women. I figured that all of you ladies had figured you knew something I didn't know, and that was how you get him. And I never could. It was like I missed that class one day. You know, they had that class, and I was absent that day because it was like, how do you get a man? How do you get somebody? And because that's what you're supposed to do when you grew up in the era that I grew up. We majored in college and we didn't take anything like business or anything that might help you in life. You took liberal arts or a language and you learned how to do table setting and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I never, you know, the MBA students wore high top funny shoes and were a little weird. So the ladies just didn't go to that. I mean, it was like these were the rules and this was the way it was. And I didn't fit with all that. You know, I didn't fit with it, and it just didn't work for me. As I said, from the very beginning, I was blackout drinking. I grew up in that time where, remember when you used to hear that if you smoked a joint, that you ended up immediately somewhere in the ghetto with a needle out of your arm? You know, you had one marijuana cigarette, and then you were on heroin forever, for life. I mean, that was what we were told. And so I ran into some guys that, you know, turned me on to drugs, but drugs didn't do much for me. I mean, alcohol was my thing. I mean, alcohol worked for me. And sure, I blacked out, and, you know, I switched around a little bit. I liked beer. You know, we drink beer in Texas. That's what we do there. And I began to switch around like it talks about in Chapter 3 right away. I mean, I switched from scotch from beer to scotch because I didn't like it. And I was trying to figure out how not to get drunk and black out. I never really understood much about drinking. I mean, I didn't think about it a lot. It was just something you did, and it worked for me so well. And so from the time I started drinking, it never occurred to me not to drink. It never occurred to me that booze was a problem. What I tried to do was to figure out how not to throw up or how not to black out. My first year in college, I was in the infirmary like 23 times from drinking. And I didn't know it was from drinking. I thought that I was allergic to the beer and hops, and so my allergies would kick in when I'd drink a lot of beer. And I'd get sick, you know, and I'd throw up, and I wouldn't remember what happened. And I thought I had a medical problem. You know, I thought I had an allergy. And I ended up, you know, my parents ended up moving, and my father got sober at Alcoholics Anonymous, and my mother continued to drink, and my parents moved to California, and I came to California with them, and finished college and got a job right out of college teaching. My parents sort of pushed me out of the house and said, you know, you got to go to work. I was real comfortable being a student. I mean, it was real safe there for me. And I don't know how it is for you, but every time I've had to make a decision in life, it's tough. You know, it's like, I don't want to do it. I want to stay and be complacent and get comfortable and wallow around, you know, in the comfort of what I'm doing and where I am. And here I was, you know, about to be graduated from college, and I wasn't going to do what the rules said that I'd grown up with that you're supposed to do. There wasn't a him waiting around the corner. You know, I didn't have a prospect to get married, and I didn't know what else to do, so I was going to go to graduate school. It just seemed like the thing to do to me. What would happen is that I would drink and black out and then, you know, trash people's apartments or do things that nobody wanted me around anymore. So, you know, my dates, unless they drank more than I did, never wanted me around after, you know, just after a few dates or after a particular blackout. And I can remember there'd be times where I could drink and drink and drink and not get sick and not get drunk and not black out. And then there'd be other times where, you know, it seems like I would black out immediately. And when we moved to California, I had been to some AA meetings with my father, and I remember thinking that going to an AA meeting and thinking in California with him, and thinking, you know, you people really have it. It's very interesting what you have here. I remember thinking, and it was very exciting to me and glamorous to suffer. And I thought, God, you've really suffered a lot. And, you know, the only thing, I mean, you really have it. There was something that I was attracted to in these rooms. You know, I didn't have a problem. I had a living problem, but I didn't have any kind of a drinking problem. But I was attracted to the way you lived and the way you greeted one another and the way you smiled at one another. And it was really interesting to me. But you couldn't drink, you know. I mean, you had everything, but you couldn't drink. You had it all here, I thought, but you couldn't drink. I can remember in college, I dated a guy who had attempted suicide, and I thought, God, isn't that glamorous? I mean, there was something about suffering that I was attracted to. You know, it was like, it was just a real exciting thing to me to suffer. And my image of myself was that I was crazy. I mean, I never fit any place, and I never felt comfortable. And I felt more comfortable with men than I did with women. You know, you women, and just, again, there was some magic or secret that you had that I didn't understand it. And I spent a lot of time watching you and trying to figure out what it was you did and how you could succeed in life and I couldn't, and what you know, magic. I mean, I figured you had some secret power. And I missed that class. And I really thought I was crazy. And I can remember crawling up sober after doing my laundry. You know, I'd get down in the closet in the warm clothes and lie there and cuddle up in a heap, hoping somebody would come find me, you know, and take me off to the institution. And what I expected is they'd take me off to the institution and lock the door, and the key would go clunk, you know, on some metal floor, and that's where I'd stay. I mean, I expected that I was crazy, and someday you'd find out, people out there would find out, and that's where they'd take me, and that's what they'd do with me. As I say, we ended up coming to California. My drinking progressed to the point that every time I drank daily, I was very careful because I'd been to some AA meetings and I knew that you hid booze and I knew what you did here. You know, I knew that you drank in the morning. So I was very careful not to do that, not to drink in the morning except on weekends and not to hide booze. However, I was living alone. There was no one to hide the booze from. So, you know, I had all the answers. I mean, I was just dangerous. I'd been to two or three AA meetings, and I knew what you did, and I was determined not to do it. I also kind of had this sense that it ran in families somehow, and I think I knew at some level I was really in trouble with my drinking. I ended up taking what I now know is a geographical things. People, places, things weren't kind to me in California. California didn't work out for me at all. I taught a couple of years, and I, you know, got jilted one more time, got dumped by some guy that I was hanging out with, and I, you know, I was kind of floating along, and my mother's alcoholism was progressing, and things were bad all the way around in my life, and I decided that I had not had the trouble in Texas that I had had in California, and California had not been good to me. So I took what I now know is a geographical. I went back to Texas, where they loved me and where things had been good, and I lasted about 6 weeks in Texas. I drank round the clock. I lost cars. I took trips, you know, to Florida and to some other places that I'm not sure where they were. I sort of became a jet setter, you know. That's what I'd always wanted to be as a little kid. And I ended up becoming that in the last days of my drinking, but not exactly the way I wanted to. It was like the more lack of self-worth I had and the more down I got and the more miserable I felt, the more I tried to surround myself with so-called, you know, attractive people. Because it was like, gee, if I could hang on to someone that was attractive or that seemed moderately healthy and wasn't a drunk, then it would be better for me. You know, and it never was. I mean, it was an inside job all the way. I met a fellow in Dallas that I liked. He was a lawyer. And he wasn't married, and I decided that I was going to get my hooks into him one way or the other. And he didn't drink as much as I did, and that was always a bad sign. And we ended up, you know, having a few dates, and I remember sitting in his apartment one evening and looking at the bottle, the wine bottle, and it was half empty. And I thought, I remember the last thing I remember thinking is, gee, I'm really controlling it tonight. You know, I really got it licked tonight. And then we started drinking Stingers, and it was all over. And I blacked out and came to, and I had torn everything up. And it was like it was, you know, the books were out of the shelf. It was like somebody had come in and trashed this place. And that somebody was me. And that realization began to set in. And I remember going, he took me home. He was gone when I woke up about 5 in the morning. Sometime in that night, I had called a friend of mine, a very close friend from high school that I'd known, who'd been a dear friend, and she hung up on me. She said, "I don't want you calling me anymore. I'm tired of this." And I'd been calling her in the middle of the night drunk for a lot of years. And she said, "I don't want you to do this anymore." And it was just one of those moments of clarity that we have. This guy came back and he looked at me and he said, "You're going home." And he said, he kind of pushed me out of the car, you know. And that's how, you know, they don't want you around. They don't walk you to the door anymore. It's like, out. And he said, I think you better look, you know, do something about your drinking. And I remember thinking, you know, I can't believe, I was incensed at the way he was talking to me. But what I had, that moment of clarity was that I had seen myself acting like my mother had acted, like I had seen her act, with the personality change and with the blackout drinking and with the horror, you know, that is our disease that we inflict on others. And I saw it in myself. And I did not think I was alcoholic. I was too young. I was 25 years old. I was a professional person. I was a teacher. I just was, you know, had a series of bad breaks. But what I did know is that what we do in Alcoholics, what you do here in Alcoholics Anonymous, was that you put people's lives back together. And so I called Alcoholics Anonymous, not for my drinking problem, but because I had a mental problem. And I came here to try to help, you know, it's a con job. I was always a pretty good con artist. And I came here, I mean, I had learned that growing up in Texas. We Texas girls learn that early. And I had grown up, what I decided is I'd come to Alcoholics Anonymous because you had good group therapy, and I would let you help, you know, me get my mental problem straightened out so I could go back out and drink. And that was the reason I called Alcoholics Anonymous. It was another con. And when I called, they were having a meeting, and I knew what you do here. See, you call, and a call comes in, and you drop everything. And my father used to get up at 3 in the morning and go on these 12-step calls, and I thought, why aren't they coming to me? I mean, don't they know who I am? I finally called, and no one's coming. And they were having a meeting, and finally, after about the third or fourth phone call, you know, my insistence, they told me exactly what, you know, was going on. And they told me that there would be a meeting that night. And I remember the lady that called me that afternoon, she said to me, she said, "You'll be able to find yourself here and to get sober and to quit drinking." And I said, "Well, that's not what concerns me. What concerns me is that I don't have any character, and I want to get character. And I don't know what character is, but I didn't have it, you know. I mean, I wasn't thinking about the drinking because that wasn't my problem." And what happened to me is I walked into this meeting in Dallas, Texas, in a little neighborhood not too far from where I lived, and it was kind of a skid row place. I mean, I wasn't living in the nicest place in town. It was kind of a borderline skid row place. And, you know, these folks weren't college graduates, and they weren't my age. You know, I was the kid. I mean, the youngest one was 40, the ripe old age of 40 probably. But I walked in there, and they welcomed me with open arms. You know how we do with folks. I mean, we just open our arms up and you love them back to health. And that's what they did for me. I mean, I remember walking in that room and thinking, this is where I belong. This is what I've been looking for all those times out there. You know, I don't know if I'm alcoholic or not. I know I'm crazy. And I know this is where I want to be. And I was deathly afraid you wouldn't let me stay and that you wouldn't accept me. And that I was only 25 and I'd only been drinking for about 8 years and that maybe I didn't measure up. And I spent, you know, a few months terrified that somebody was going to find me out and make me leave, you know, that I didn't qualify. I qualified in the feelings. And that's what I like to talk about. And I'm going to spend the rest of the time talking about being sober and about the feelings, because that's the feelings that I used to have, and with my emotions, that's what made me drink. And it's the feelings that I have that the steps and the program and the fellowship and you people have helped put back together for me to enable me to function in life without drinking. And that's, to me, what we do here. And if you're new, that's what it's all about, you know. The thing that was interesting, when I first went to this group, they said, you know, come in and sit down and shut up and listen and don't give advice. And, you know, and there were a lot of things that they said to do. And one of them was they said stick with the winners. And I didn't know what a winner was. I had no idea. But this was in Texas. And in Texas AA, they always people, when they talk, they always give their sobriety date. And so that was the only way that I knew what a winner was. If someone had been sober a long time, then I thought they must be a winner. And I thought, like a lot of us do, that everybody here was perfect. I mean, you were all wonderful. You paid your debts. You didn't commit adultery. I mean, you did all those Christian things that they used to talk about in the Southern Baptist Church. I mean, I just thought you had it all together. You were perfect. And I can remember this person that I met that wasn't perfect, and I fell off the pedestal immediately. I mean, I was heartbroken and shocked to find out that there wasn't someone in Alcoholics Anonymous that was perfect. The two most important things to me when I first got sober were that I could dance and I could eat Mexican food without drinking beer. I mean, life, I had a real important set of values there. And so they said to me, you know, that's easy. So the first week, a whole group of us went out and we ate Mexican food and we drank Cokes and iced tea and we went dancing. And, you know, so that took care of those two priorities right away. So it's like now you're left with your life and your resentments and your fear and, you know, the character defects that our book talks about. And, you know, I don't know how it is for you, but I didn't have any of those character defects. You know, I just kind of drank too much periodically and blacked out and wandered into Alcoholics Anonymous because I didn't, you know, find a husband or something. I mean, that was sort of the way it was. I didn't realize. I mean, I remember thinking about anger and hostility and fear and some of the, you know, the character defects that we talk about here and that got us drunk. And I remember, you know, I just couldn't figure out that I had any of those. I mean, I'd lived alone, and I'd been a teacher, and I hadn't really hurt anybody in my life. You know, I didn't have any amends to make, really. All this was stuff that applied to you. My case was different. Whatever you suggested that I do, I thought, well, if I wanted to do it, I did it. But if I didn't, I figured, well, that doesn't really apply to me because I don't have that particular character defect. And so, you know, this it's sort of a lesson, you know, my story is sort of a lesson in how not to do it, because I stayed sober, but that's not the way you're supposed to do it. And I think it took me a long time to grow up in Alcoholics Anonymous and to stop doing that. And I have been suicidal and homicidal, you know, in sobriety because of those very things, because of staying aloof and staying separate and thinking that my case is different. And what applies to you does not apply to me. I had changed. I was between jobs when I came here. I was unemployed. And I had made a decision. I can remember standing out in the schoolyard and looking at airplanes go over and thinking, if I could just get out of here, you know, if I could just fly away, it would be wonderful. And so I made a decision to become a flight attendant, or a stewardess, as we called them in those days. And so I made that decision while drinking and then got sober. And so then I was stuck with, what are you going to do? And they told me in the group, there was a lady who had flown for American Airlines in my group in Dallas, and she said, if you fly, you will never stay sober. And I thought, you just watch me, sister, because I am going to do it. And that was all I needed. If you do this, you won't, you know, you'll never stay sober. And I thought, you just watch, because I'm going to stay sober and I'm going to do it. And so I got sober on November 23rd, 1968, and I have not found it, well, I have found it necessary to take a drink, but I have not had a drink or any other mind-altering chemicals since then. And I think it's important to really talk about sobriety dates, because that's what we do here. We come here and we work the steps and we get a sponsor and we go to meetings. And I didn't hear 30 meetings in 30 days. What they told me was, you go to a meeting every time you drink. And I was a daily drinker, so I went to a meeting every day. And, you know, they said to me, this is just what you do. And you get a sponsor and you stick with the winners. And I was sort of between jobs and moving from Dallas to another city, and so I didn't get a sponsor right away. But I did go ahead and was accepted for this airline. And so on January 13th, 1969, it was that day of the great Super Bowl with the Jets beating the Colts. It was one with Joe Namath. I'm really dating myself now here, but it was that great. I watched that Super Bowl in a bar and didn't drink. I mean, it was just a wonderful occasion. I was about 5 weeks sober or 4 weeks sober, 4 weeks dry. I really wasn't sober. And what I did is I went to a new town, to Miami, Florida, where I didn't know anyone, and took a new job with new people, new friends. It was like starting over. And, you know, for me, that was a gift. It was what I really needed. I think about all of us who get sober and who have to go by the same old drinking haunts with the same old friends and, you know, the same old family members hanging around and the same, you know, wife or husband. And it wasn't like that for me. I mean, my God chose to get me in the right place at the right time, and that was that to start over. I mean, I was given that real gift in sobriety, and that was to begin anew. And I can remember I shared a room with five other ladies. I didn't like women much anyway, and here I am in this motel room with five of them. And I would put the cover up over my head and with a flashlight, and I'd turn the big book around, you know, so that the cover was blank. And I would lie under the cover with a flashlight reading the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was terrified of drinking. I knew that if I drank again, I would end up in the institution and I would not ever make it back. And so I knew that I had to stay sober. And I knew that if they discovered there, you know, the airline was Pan American, and I had lied on my application when it said, you know, have you ever used alcohol or drugs? I said no. And I knew that if they discovered that I was reading the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I would be fired. And that scared me to death. And so, because I knew there was no place else for me to go. You know, this was a brand new beginning for me. And, you know, a real gift, a real opportunity to be able to start over. And after the first week, we could get out. And so I called AA and found out where the nearest meeting was. And I remember taking two buses. I had to transfer, and I'd catch a bus. And I did that every night when I could get out, and every weekend for that 6 weeks. After the flight attendant training was over, I was based in Miami, and I lived there for a year and a half, and I lived about a mile away from my group. And I had this bicycle called Green, and I would ride Green back and forth to the group every day. Every day when I was not working, I would be spending at a clubhouse with Alcoholics Anonymous and going to meetings. And I looked around, and there was a lady there in the group that I thought would be a nice sponsor for me. They didn't ever give sobriety dates in Florida, and so I didn't know, you know, what a winner was, but I thought she seemed like a nice lady, and so I asked her to be my sponsor, and she said okay. And about a week later, there was this big group politics thing. I don't know if you've ever been in one of those, but they bring out the very worst in me, all this stuff that sometimes goes on when we forget about principles and get involved in personalities. That makes me really crazy, and I have learned that I have to stay away from all that stuff, but because it brings out, I mean, I get angry and you know, homicidal about it. I mean, I get really upset. So what happened is that this lady was stealing from the treasury, and people got mad at her, you know, and so they sort of kicked her out of the group or something. I mean, I don't know what they did to her, but it really made me mad at the group. So here I am, you know, I'm about 6 weeks or 2 months sober, and I'm mad at AA, and and which is not a very good fix to be in. The other thing is that I was still having all the same emotions that I'd had drinking, you know, and the time went on, and at about 6 months in sobriety, I met a guy who was kind of a guru in Florida, AA. In fact, he spoke all over the Southeast, and I led the meeting the night he talked at our group, and I went up after him and thanked him for his talk, and he said, "Do you have a sponsor?" And I said, "No, I don't have a sponsor." And he said, "Well, I think you need a sponsor, and I'm going to be your sponsor." And I remember thinking, well, you know, men aren't supposed to sponsor women, but my case is different. I don't like women anyway, and this other woman, you know, she was stealing from the group treasury. And so I'll let him be my sponsor. I didn't have much of an ego problem. And he was at the right place. I mean, I was in the right place at the right time. He was wonderful for me, and it was the best sponsorship I ever could have had, and I'm very grateful to him. He helped me with the steps. He had the courage to say things to me that nobody else had ever said in my life that I needed to hear if I was going to take a look at myself, a cold, hard, honest look, and stay sober. And it was absolutely what I had to have, and I'm really grateful to him. He has had a lot of physical problems. I was real fortunate to see him last November, and I had not seen him in about 18 years. And he is not sober today because he's had a lot of medical problems, and he also has developed a pill problem. And I had a lot of mixed feelings about that. You know, this is the person that I think really saved my life, but he has not been able to maintain sobriety. It's one of the ironies of the fellowship that sometimes the people that bring us here, you know, go back out. I'm really thinking about people right back out. My home group is the Wednesday night speakers meeting in a South Coast group in Laguna Beach, and we've had two of our real long-time people, one with 10 years and another with 16 years, go back out. And so I've really been thinking a lot about people with sobriety, long-term sobriety, who go back out and drink. It's a real... it really brings you back upright, and it's made me really take a look at and do a gratitude list and look at why I'm here and what I'm doing here. I continued to have a lot of problems with relationships. you know, it was like, it was a continuation of everything that had been going on drinking, and it just continued on into sobriety. And it took me quite a while to begin to get real comfortable. In about 1971, I had about almost 4 years of sobriety, I guess, and I met this fellow, and I was living in San Francisco. My story sober is like most people's drinking. I mean, I lived in Miami and San Francisco and Los Angeles and moved around a lot. You know, it's real easy if you're trying to hide and stay in the back row in meetings. One of the things you can do if the going gets tough, you just move. You just switch jobs and move around. And I did that a lot, and that really kept me. And the other thing that kept me, I think, from really growing and staying with the steps and staying getting close to people is that I was in a job as a flight attendant where I was always too hungry and too lonely and too tired and all those things they tell you not to ever be. I mean, I was always never up and down. The other thing is that because I didn't have a consistent schedule, I couldn't be a secretary of a group. The only thing I ever did was make cakes. I kind of appointed myself to be the cake lady. Anyway, I met this fellow in about 1971, and he was great. You know, he was just terrific, and he traveled, and we had, you know, we were both sober, and we were living in north of San Francisco in the Bay Area in a beautiful place, you know, a beautiful place that I lived. And it occurred to me that all the things that I had ever wanted drinking and thinking that I was going to grow up as a little girl to be. I mean, I'm flying around the world, and I met this great guy, and we're going to get married, and you know, life was really beautiful. And there was just one problem with this relationship, and that was that he was already married. And it's real tough to maintain and to have an honest relationship and work an honest program when you're living in a dishonest way. And I learned that the hard way. I learned that I didn't have relationships, I had obsessions, you know, and my obsessions really got me and kept me sick and kept me from working the steps and kept me from taking a look at character defects. I can remember it was only about 6 or 7 years ago that I realized I was angry. I can still today, I'll be driving along the freeway and, you know, in traffic, it's always in traffic, and somebody honks at you, and you know, it just makes me crazy, and I always give them the bird. And I came home one day, and my husband said, please don't do that, you know, you're going to get shot. I understand freeway shootings, you know, I mean, I just have this rage that sometimes boils up inside of me, you know, I want to kill people, and you know, and I was kind of this cute little girl that wandered into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was never angry. And it took me a long time to begin to work on these character defects and to really do it. I had another great surrender. The first surrender was when I came to the fellowship, and the second surrender for me was really when I over the breakup of another obsessive relationship. I like to say I don't have relationships, I have obsessions, and God help you if I get obsessed with you, because I'm going to get you no matter what. And the thing that was key for me is that I realized that I was not whole and I was not complete until I had a relationship. It was like I needed to have another half to make me feel complete. In working the steps, in getting back to women's meetings, which I did at 10 years of sobriety. At 10 years of sobriety, I didn't take a cake because I thought I had nothing to give back because I was so depressed about this relationship that had, you know, again, had broken up. And I began to really get serious with the program again, and I got a new sponsor, and I started going to women's meetings, and I started letting women really get close to me, and I started getting close to the women, and I have learned so much from both of you, women and men in the program, but in recent years, the women have really put me back together and helped put me, love me back to health and helped me through the steps and helped me stay sober and get level and get even. The thing that I want to close with is that I got very comfortable being single and who I was. I began to be grateful for all that I had done in my life. I had started a business, and it had been a very successful business, and I was very pleased with that, and I had left the airline before starting the business, and I had developed a wonderful, loving, kind, adult, mature relationship with my parents, and I'd been able to do that through the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and which was a real gift for me, and I got very comfortable with who I am and what I'm doing. About 4 or 5 years ago, I ran into an old friend who had been a good friend of mine and who I'd known for a number of years, who's sober on the program, and 4 years ago, we got married. And, you know, we're sort of trudging the road of happy destiny together. It isn't always, you know, roses, but we just have a great time. We go to meetings, and we have AA friends, and we laugh, and you know, life is really very good to me. And the program has been good to me. You have been good to me. And I hope that we can continue to be good to one another. I love to laugh about how we gossip and we're always backbiting and carrying on with one another. But the main thing is that, you know, we treat each other with dignity. And we love each other back to health. And you have given me my life. Everything that I am, I owe to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd like to thank you for letting me share.